Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dolby Chase, and today my guest is the amazing Mr. Slangston Hughes. How are you, Slangston?
I'm great. How's it going?
It's going very well for me, thank you. So what have you been up to lately?
Well, that is an interesting question because I'm usually doing multiple things at one time, but lots of things and stuff, teaching, and editing a really big book on, and watching a whole lot of Star Trek over like this week.
Wonderful, wonderful. So tell me about the really big book of poetry.
Yeah, I'm finishing up editing a book of poems. It's kind of like my personal anthology almost. It's worked from 2002 through 2016.
Nice. Do you know what the title will be?
It's called Language Arts and Griot Glimpses. It's like an amalgamation of two smaller books that were previously published on a smaller scale by myself, and then newer work, and then all kind of like put together into this one like Bible of language.
Nice, a Bible of language. I love that statement. When do you think it'll be out?
I'm going to say in time for National Poetry Month.
Nice. Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. I was wondering if I could prevail upon you to read us something to start the show off.
Sure, definitely. There's like 6.5 different poems circling around in my head, trying to be chosen as the one. Let me see. The biggest difference between working for a living and living for a living is never feeling dead as long as you're alive. It can take the light from the most distant stars up to 13.5 billion years to actually reach our eyelids. A fleeting flicker of existence blinking backwards. But what if when you looked at the stars, you were actually looking at yourself? Looking at yourself, looking at yourself. Mind blown. Carl Sagan reincarnated into an exhale of sacred geometry and sandals from a chest filled with buds and shattered light bulbs. The galaxy is always mouth open, solar implosion, God's flesh broken into motorbike, poet, no, with just microphones, blessed to be turned on in that moment when the universe decides to speak through us and to the venue that is our lives. Poetry, fuck poetry, people are more important. And editing is synonymous with eternity. The best poems aren't even poems. The best poems are people. So when the sky's not big enough, I write planets. Green constellations with braille on my vocal cords. I don't write poems. I don't spit poems. I choke up omens. Because what gives words power is the purpose of the person pushing the pen. Punctuation that goes past the page. Pronunciation wrapped in vocal flame. And this body ain't nothing but a bottle, so I don't just speak to my water. I cause it to erupt into tsunami. Poems. Nah, son. This is a spirit bomb on steroids, and Goku is black. This be that true truth. Not metaphorical, but metaphysical. Literary origami that can reshape the anatomical structure of your galaxy. Just imagine that if people are like planets and each individual creates the very gravity that keeps us on the ground, then maybe, family equals every single person you are around. The only thing that makes anyone worth anything are the people who mean everything to them. Transmuted human beings of light, we are God's favorite breakdance move, streaking across the sky at night, poetic avatar of the sun, moon, and stars. So if I said a poem at the quasars, aliens be like, damn, he got bars. This is an ocean of lungs, a thousand tongues of fire spitting, the earth beats in deep drums, this poem filled flesh that we wear like regrets, this wind, this breath we are given that embodies our faith, proving that love is not an emotion, but the fuel that makes us levitate. So when struggle breaks you open, remember it is only so that you can bleed light and bend your spirit, transmute suffering into something worth giving, speak life into existence, because the biggest difference between working for a living and living for a living is never feeling dead as long as you're alive.
Mm. Wow. That's beautiful. Where did this poem come from?
So that poem is kind of like one of those, it's like I either write something where the process takes a long time or something where like it just kind of all just spills out at once. And that was one of the ones where the process really took a long time because there were so many different ideas that I was trying to, like, it's like I don't write a poem until, like, all the energy is right there and the energy is just, like, collecting for so long with that particular poem. And so it's called Righteous Alchemy, spelled like Righteous Alchemy with a W. And I did a TED Talk, and that was the theme of it. And so after I did the TED Talk, then all the notes for the poem that I had collected just kind of made sense. And I kind of draw maps for the poem, but the poem doesn't end up being super long because I tend to write really long. And once I did the TED Talk, then, like, the poem itself just seemed so much easier to write. And so it kind of ended up being the same concept and things of the TED Talk condensed down into, like, a smaller version.
Nice. Nice. And how was it
the
being
opening
TED
line?
Okay, go ahead.
Line,
no, please.
I had for so long, but just couldn't figure out everything I wanted to go with it. And one of my students, even like their college essay, ripped like the opening quote. And the teacher was like, "Where'd you get that from?" Like, "My poetry coach." And they're like, "No, you Google that. That's not." I'm like, "Well, I wasn't brilliant enough to think of this quote." And then the rest of the poem kind of just like ended up being like seed thoughts of that opening and closing statement.
Yeah, I love that. And I love how you come right back to it in the end of the poem. That opening line is really a stunner. It totally is. What was the name of that poem?
Righteous Alchemy. The same name.
Righteous Alchemy. Nice. So you were in a TED Talk, you said, and I've always admired TED Talks and the people who are in them. What was that like?
That was a lot of fun. I ended up being the shout out to Sal Salman, who was the curator for TEDx Baltimore for like the last 10 years, and I did the last talk of the last conference that he did around this time last year actually, and he had me be like the closing speaker of his final TED conference, and that was like really a big thing. It was pretty cool, really awesome experience.
Yeah, it would be. Wow. Such a prestigious position to have in the TED Talk as well. So, wow. Congratulations on that.
And it was like NASA astronauts and like CEOs and all kinds of stuff that went on throughout the day. So to be like the person to close out that entire lineup was really an honor.
Yeah. To bat cleanup for all that. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So there have been amazing things happening in your life, including the fact that you're a member of Slammageddon, the Baltimore Adult Slam team in 2016 that finished ranked number one in the country at the National Poetry Slam. So, I mean, I'm just in awe of what happened. Tell me what it was like at the National Poetry Slam for you and Team Baltimore.
It was amazing. It was definitely an amazing experience. And it was really a combination of pretty much a four-year journey for me because, long story short, or maybe long story long, I kind of got introduced to slam poetry when I first came to Baltimore in 2001 as a college student, fresh out of high school, when I saw poetry happening, spoken word happening, and I was like, wow, this is kind of like what happens when I freestyle with no beat, and I start just going to open mics and freestyling poems, and then I saw a slam, and I jumped in the slam. It was like a collegiate slam. I was representing Coppin State, and my team members didn't show up, and I ended up slamming all the rounds by myself. But it was like really a really awesome and intense experience. And then I came to a venue across from Johns Hopkins University called Slamicide. At the time, it was the PSI venue for Baltimore's national team. And I started going there like every other week. Like every other Monday I would go there, and the Monday off from that I would go to like the hip hop open mic. And it was, and all these amazing poets were there: Sonya Renee, Twain Dooley, Gail Danley, Chris August, like Grandma Dave, on and on and on. And they were representing, like, I think at the time Baltimore and DC had like a dual team, and you had to to battle without being the top two just to get on that team going to nationals. So some really, really incredible teams came out of that venue. And then fast forward years later, that venue had disbanded, and there hadn't been an adult team going to nationals for maybe about 5 or 6 years. And I was involved, and the head coach for the organization that sent the youth team from Baltimore to Brave New Voices every year, and I had been doing that. And so I was like, we need to – like, Baltimore has so much talent, we need to have representation on the adult national scene again. So I started Slammageddon, and first venue didn't end up working out. Then we restarted a year later at another venue, and then we got moved from that spot to another spot. Then we got kicked out of that spot. Then we were doing it in my friend's living room, who had helped me start it, student, and Micah. And then we finally found a permanent home beginning of 2015, a venue called Soulful Emergence Art Gallery. And their co-owner is actually my co-slam master for Slammageddon. And we got certified and everything and finally kind of stabilized the venue. And we went to nationals in 2015 and finished in the top 10. And then we went back this year, and only second year as a venue and won the whole thing. So it was just like a whole journey that kind of like came to this final stage, and was just like, wow, literally final stage. And it was definitely awesome experience. And definitely have to shout out Soulful Emergence Art Gallery, and definitely the great asset that they've been. And not just to Slammageddon, but to the Baltimore arts community in general.
Lovely. And if people want to attend like a slam at Slammageddon, where would they go in Baltimore?
Oh, so really awesome thing that happened recently. Starting off this year, we just had our first slam of the year this past Thursday. We Soulful Emergence Art Gallery, Slammageddon, we collaborated and merged with another event called Baltimore Art Rising. That's a really big open mic, and so they were doing head-to-head slams, and like one poet versus another poet. But now we've merged with them, and Slammageddon is the main feature every month at Art Rising. So it's every first Thursday. It's Art Rising and Slammageddon together, and it happened every first Thursday in Baltimore at Impact Hub on North Avenue, right at the corner of North and Charles Street.
Well, good. Anybody who's in and around Baltimore, make sure you check that out. I wish that I could. I'm pretty far away from Baltimore right now, but when I'm in the area, I'm going to look it up for sure. We're about halfway through the interview. I was wondering if I might be able to get you to read something else?
Which poem? What's the next poem trying to call its way out my ear? So, really interesting, fun fact. I mentioned it at the beginning, but fun fact, if you will, about Langston Hughes. I love Star Trek. Like, I'm a huge Trekkie. People have no idea. This year at MPF in the Nerd Slam, I represented the Star Trek category and, like, answered the people thought was probably unanswerable Super Trek question. But to me, this is like, wow, this is so easy. And my favorite episode of all episodes is the episode of Deep Space Nine titled The Visitors. This is the one where Captain Sisko gets knocked into a subspace dimension, leaving his son Jake, who witnessed the entire incident, to believe that he is dead. Until a random moment throughout his life, his father begins to appear, then disappear, causing him to relive the tragedy over and over again on repeat. It isn't until Jake, who is a writer, discovers that if he kills himself while they're both present, it will reset the loop in the timeline, giving them a second chance. Super nerdy, super Trekkie sci-fi stuff, I know. But if only it was that easy to get your father back. We are warp signatures of our parents' dreams. And my father is a visitor who has always dematerialized in and out of my existence. When I was a kid, every time he came to visit, it was like he was back from the dead, a walking Project Genesis. But at the end of the day, when his car drove away, I was automatically transported to his funeral. As I grew older, I learned to put a cloaking device over my emotions, holodeck sitting beneath my eyelids. But how can I live long and prosper when every morning my father is a mirror-mirror universe facing the reflection of my dead father's face? Except in both of these realities, Spock has a beard and is always emotionally compromised. I remember one Christmas as I attempted to open up the hailing frequencies between our hurting heartbeats. He put his shield up, so I fired, so torn torpedoes from my fist in an attempt to reunify two broken worlds. And he would become closer to me than the orbits of Romulus and Remus, an emotional transference of a mind meld between father and son, unable to compensate for the sugar levels in this warp core, this diabetic dialogue as guttural as crayons. The day my father died, his hospital room smelled like ketamine. Have you ever had your hope massacred? Well, it feels like Jake, like Worf, or Wesley, like the son of Sarek, a young James Tiberius watching his father's starship explode while still trapped inside the womb, when your hero literally has no leg left to stand on and diabetes just amputated your belief in God. Ever since my father's death, I've been haunted by the most beautiful nightmare, disguised as real life, where he is alive, and I can't believe it's true. Then as soon as I'm prepared to embrace Shatari and accept this as miracle, victory turns Kobayashi Maru, slingshot around the sun, as suddenly the Stardate shifts, and I'm still just a kid crying as his father drives away, and there isn't enough dilithium in my dreams to bring him back from the dead. Noticing his pain, struggling to speak a full sentence, I hand him a pen and piece of paper as universal translator. The last words I remember my father telling me, write something good, son.
Wow. How long ago did your father pass?
2004.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that.
It took me over a decade to finally write the poem.
Yeah. And what prophetic final words. I love how his final words are also the final words in the poem. It just resonates so well. Do you often write about family and situations in your life, or do you feel like you write more globally?
I think both happen. my fourth favorite poem, my fourth favorite poet in the history of planet Earth is Pablo Neruda. And
yeah.
I think what's really cool about Pablo Neruda, he always talks about how political poems are the poems that should come last to the writer, because political poetry is really just personal poetry, because it's about how you see the world. And so it's like all the
yeah.
personal stuff is what develops how you view the world. So the political is really personal. And so
yeah.
The bulk of my work, I think it's probably things that you would call political writing. But the work that is the most, I feel like, reflective of who I am and probably the shift that my writing took the most in the last few years were those things that were, like, about family members or about personal experiences. And I find that the things that I write that are seen as very political or visceral and attacking certain issues, the way I write those things ultimately is framed based off of the things that I experience as a human being and as a person,
right.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely does. So if he's your fourth favorite writer, who are the other three above him?
So my favorite all time, so I think maybe last poetry, no, maybe two National Poetry Months ago, what I did was day by day, I did a list of my 100 favorite poets in the history of planet Earth.
Yeah.
On those on Facebook and compiled it and like use it in curriculum and stuff now. But the top three are Rumi, Khalil Gibran, and my all-time favorite poet in the history of the planet is Amiri Baraka.
Good choices. Good choices. Tell me about Amiri Baraka and you. How does he resonate with you? Why is he your favorite?
Well, one, because I feel like out of all of my favorite poets and of all the writers of this era of human history, his work in particular is what most laid the foundation for, I feel like, who I am as a writer and the particular school of writing that I come out of and a lot of my mentors. If you really look into the DNA of the Black radical tradition and this era of poetry in general, his work in particular laid the foundation for so much work like it that followed. It made work like it that followed possible. And while there's a whole lot of others who were in that era with him and followed and did the same thing for writers, I would say, of my school of thought, poetically and politically, if you really look at the history of it, his was kind of what for a lot of those like him, from him publishing a lot of the beat writers and then publishing a lot of the black arts writers. He was kind of like at the central nexus of both the beat generation and the black arts movement. And then those things led to so many other things in spoken word and down the line, and how hip-hop was influenced by the work of him and Gil Scott-Heron and the Last Poet. And then in my generation, poetry and spoken word influenced by hip-hop was like such a cyclical thing. And if you look at like the nucleus of that cipher, his work sits right in the center of it. The second reason being that when I was a freshman in college at Coppin, they used to have the annual Spring Writers Conference, and I got to meet him and Sonia Sanchez there. And
wow.
He was the keynote speaker there right after his Somebody Blew Up America poem about 9/11 had just came out. It was right after he had been, they had abolished his position as poet laureate of New Jersey. All of that had just happened, and he was the keynote at the Writers' Conference at my school that year. So it was just like, I was like literally sitting front row as he was reading, and then got to talk to him afterwards. And then met him several times and talked to him several times after that as well. And I always remember and tell the story of I had like this cassette tape of like a like all these like hip hop songs that I had done, and like I was buying his book, and I like, gave him a cassette tape, and like he was just like, brother, I'll see you on the other side. And I never quite understood exactly what that meant, but it was just cool that he told me he was gonna see you on the other side. And then the last time I saw him before he passed, I had written this really long poem. It was influenced by his 9/11 poem. And it was this long poem I wrote, like 12 pages long. It was a poem version of a 33-page essay I had written on 9/11, and it like directly influenced by his writing on this event. And I gave it to him like he read after a performance of his play Dutchman in Baltimore. And then he was like on his way out. I like ran up and like almost tackled him and like just handed him this huge poem. And he was just like, "Oh, you again?" it was definitely in a direct yet but indirect way, someone I consider not just my favorite poet ever, but like a mentor of mine. And if I was to point to any writer that's like the direct genealogical line of like how, why, and even how I'm able to write the way that I do, Mary Baraka is that representation through not just his art, but like his life as art.
Well, you know, we're coming up on the end of the show. We've got about 3.5 minutes right now. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I'd love to have you read us out of the show. Listeners, next week my guest is Clint Smith. Don't miss that. And for one last time, Mr. Slangston Hughes.
I think very fitting. I'll close with a poem that opens with one of the Mary Baraka books. And then without the undercurrent of desire to set your ass on fire. When they come for me, the first thing they'll see will be flame. We have been burning since we got here. We have been holding fire since birth, dying to open our hands and let the wind speak for us. My language is burning tongue, open wound and blackened sun. I am dead man speaking. America, you are a mouth made of maggots, screams with corpse still cadence, another poem pregnant with blood and ink and brown broken bodies. So many names staining our fingerprints that my palms have no room left for eulogy. I wrote this poem already. I wrote this poem already. I already wrote this poem. My writer's block is stained with the blood of my people. So these words better burn beautiful, better scorch the earth they bury us beneath. Coffins caught in my capillaries, graveyard in my chest. Heartbeat is crematory. My soul is on fire. And America, you are next. The moment we become tired of all these black poems is the moment we become complacent with all this black death. Another autopsy as literary art. I'm tired of holding writing workshops in the morgue with hashtags and prompts. Yesterday, I tried to meditate, and all the mantras sounded like madness, sounded like my mouth mumbling over melanated names made modern. The ancestors won't speak to me because they're too busy with orientation. How long before I have to write this same autopsy on my own, before I'm forced to wrap my family and friends in a shroud made of metaphors and write their names on it, before they are forced to pick up a pen and edit my body? And I will not ask your government for help. I will not pray to your God for that nigga. Oshun disapproves. Yemida disapproves. Ogun and Obantala demand fire and truth. Shango said, you ready to let them things go. It's time to take the targets off of our bodies and put them on theirs. Our history is a history of being baptized in the waters of this country's love, made lighter fluid. And if I, too, am America, then we gonna burn together. We gonna light this motherfucker on fire, not because we want to watch it burn, but so that maybe they will finally see the light.
Oh, bravo, bravo. Thank you so much, Langston, again. And until next week, be kind to one another. This is Spoken Heard. And I'm Susan Dobie Chase.